Hello, everyone. Welcome to CBS Sports NBA Podcast. I'm your host, Matt Moore, for this episode. Today's conversation is with Michael Levin of the Rife Ricky Sanchez podcast at LibertyBallers.com. We recorded this podcast on June 28th, a couple of days before free agency started. I'm just now being able to get it up because I was traveling and then there was free agency. Kevin Durant did a thing you may have remembered. And all this kind of stuff happened, and it was crazy, and so I wasn't able to edit it and get it down to where it needed to be for us to post it. I was at Summer League, and I took a couple days off. We're happy to be able to post it now. Michael is a longtime process truster behind Sam Hinkie in Philadelphia. He and I had a great conversation a couple of months ago on a podcast that did not get recorded on my end because I'm a moron. He hit me up the other day and was like, I have some things I need to get off my chest about the process and about the conversation about Philadelphia. This is right after the draft. So we got together, we talked about it. It's a great conversation for about an hour talking about kind of the media's role and how Philadelphia is perceived, arguments for and against Sam Hinkie in the process, and just an overall look at where the Sixers are, where they've been, and where they're going. I really hope you guys enjoy it. Here's Michael Levin on the CBS Sports NBA podcast. I know that you have some things you kind of want to get off your chest about everything that has kind of become in terms of how we now view the Sam Hinkie era in Philadelphia.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the Sixers for years. I mean, you can say since Iverson left the first time, but it was really even before then because they were bad for the last, like, 3 or 4 years. Between Iverson leaving and the Bynum trade, they were, like, the least interesting team in basketball by so much. Those Doug Collins teams, the Eddie Jordan team, there were so Mo Cheeks coach teams, like, so boring. There's nothing interesting about them whatsoever. And the Bynum trade, for as weird as it was, did start this train of, it's exciting is the wrong word, but at least they were talked about in not positively, but at least it was like, hey, we have something to discuss. This is fun. It's not just, I don't know, maybe Greg Buckner will come back and they'll win 28 games. It'll be great. But now it's fun. It's weird fun. It's sadistic fun. But the last 3 years have absolutely been versions of fun.
Now, I know that in the wake of Sam leaving and then the hiring of Brian Colangelo in particular, you kind of talked about how you're like, I may be done. Like, I just may be out. Like, I just may have exhausted everything that I have. How long did that last?
It was, okay, so Sam left beginning of April, if I'm not mistaken. And then it was about a month until the lottery. And so it was just like, because it's hard to wrap your head around. Because it wasn't just, and I think anybody that writes for Liberty Ballers or declares themselves a process person would agree with this, that it wasn't just about Sam. Like, it was never like, oh, here's this guy that we finally trust who we think is perfect and infallible and he could do no wrong. It wasn't about that. It was about, like I said before, since Iverson, the Sixers just never had a plan. So it was less about his demise and more the demise of someone with a plan and ownership getting behind that plan.
And then abandoning that plan.
And then abandoning it, right, exactly. So that was a tough thing to wrap your head around because we had like a taste of what the good life was, like trusting ownership, trusting your front office and being like, this is good. This is heading in the right direction. There's a goal, there's a philosophy, and we're not just, you know, ramming our heads into a wall and hoping that we break through and hoping that, like in 2012, Derrick Rose, Luol Deng, and Joakim Noah all get hurt in the same series so the Sixers can advance to the second round. So it was about a month, and I'm not done, obviously, as we're talking on this podcast, and I keep doing weekly, sometimes twice a weekly podcast with Spike. But it is like I get whiplash from going back and forth to being all in and like just so upset and mad at everybody.
So I thought that the reaction to, I didn't mind being upset that Sam left. I got that. And I didn't mind being upset at basically ownership capitulating. And I especially understand getting mad that the league intervened. Because, you know, the league, the league front office is typically like, well, you should probably take a long-term view of these things. That's what they do. They don't rush into decisions. They don't they don't make plans and then abandon them halfway through. And they've seen the disaster that has wrought on key markets that they care about. Like the entire problem with the Knicks is that they are inherently anti-process. Like, they are the most non-process team you're going to find. The Lakers are similarly so, and that worked out for them for a long time because they looked into Kobe Bryant, but now we're seeing kind of what has happened since, and it's really disastrous. I'm writing right now about a quote from Kevin Dean's article on Bleacher Report about how Jim Buss thought they were getting Kevin Durant and then Russell Westbrook. And it's like, there's no realism and there's no plan there.
No.
Like, they've built this young core, but that core has mainly just been the result of how terrible they've been. They haven't traded for another pick. They haven't acquired more assets.
It's almost been like they've resentfully built a young core.
Right. And there were so many concerns when Colangelo took over, and I get it because, you know, like, I got back into it with Sixers fans. I thought, like, we were in an okay place, and then the Nerlens Noel Jeff Teague trade came up, and I was like, I kind of get this, and just they went nuts. Sure. Like, that was like, and it was that rumor was like the worst of all fears for you guys, right? In that it's this short-term win-now move that sacrifices an asset that isn't going to really help you and doesn't help you get worse to get another pick. But I kind of understand Colangelo at least being like, look, we've been bad. We have a core. We have several guys. Mm-hmm. We can get a little better now. I think that that's okay. I also think that there was I will say that a lot of what came out of Sixers fans was very personal about the Colangelos. Like, it wasn't like, this is outrageous, and we're going to be stuck back in mediocrity, and this is such a bummer. That I get, but, like, personal attacks on Jerry Colangelo, architect of Team USA Basketball, who has been in the sport for, like, 40 years. I was like, okay, guys, let's at least see what he does first and not get personal with this stuff.
Well, he pretty much, you know, on the league's insistence, came in there and, like, swindled the owners into believing in him. And turning on Sam and getting to a place where he can push Sam out and then hire his son with no interview process. So this isn't against Brian. Brian's been a good to fine GM at two places, has made mistakes, but you've been in the league long enough, you make mistakes. It's about Jerry coming in and thinking, like, you know, he's just old and out of touch and thinks that, like, he's the best in terms of, like, he has a history of credibility, but like
he's had success,
but he's also, like, super old and out of touch. And,
okay, being old is not an inherently good or bad thing. That doesn't mean what
it is in terms of being out of touch. If you're not like,
no, you don't have to, like, they're not connected. It doesn't. You can have young people that aren't in touch. Him being old has nothing to do with the conversation about his ability to do the job.
Well, it does in terms of he's you know, delegating things via Skype from Phoenix. If he's not involved with the team and he's just sort of, like, lording over them from a Skype connection in Phoenix, that rubbed people the wrong way. And then hiring his son just without an interview process, there's certainly, like, you can certainly condemn how that was done, and it certainly doesn't look good for the team as a whole and ownership.
Whoa. Okay, you just said it doesn't look good for the team. The optics are, like, you're saying the optics are bad. Yeah. But the entire argument against the process was that you're losing just to lose and this is non-competitive. That was all optics. It wasn't about, if you get to the end of the process, the process was about, let's have a plan, let's work towards it, let's sacrifice optics in order to get the assets that we want, right?
I don't know that was sacrificing optics. I don't agree with that. I think it was, everybody knows what we're doing. We are building for the future. We're going to have, as Sam said, the longest view in the room. We're going to think long-term. We're not going to try to win now. We're not going to pursue mid-level free agents that won't move the needle. We're just going to, like, plan for the future. And that's...
But those aren't the optics. The optics were they're losing on purpose, right? That wasn't the reality, but that was the optics.
Sure, but...
And Hinkie and the optics were Hinkie's not... He has no personal touch. He doesn't have the connections.
Well, that's all narrative drawn that were.
But you're doing the exact same thing.
You're doing
Jerry, where you're building a narrative of, well, he's old and he's communicating from Skype, and it's like that, you have, that has no real relevance on the decisions themselves or what the approach is.
I think it was more of a turn of the league is inserting themselves in this situation. Here comes this like beacon of like we're gonna deviate from what we've been doing.
Oh, traditionalism.
Yes. And that rubbed everybody, at least in terms of the people that I agree with, the wrong way. You're right. I think you can spin the optics one way or the other. And
my point is,
I personally don't care that much about it, so much as I care about, like, it's not even the optics of interviewing more candidates. It's just a good decision making. Why not just look for other GMs in better places? What Sam did when he like was hiring Brett Brown was he interviewed a ton of coaches and learned things about them.
Those are all quality.
Exactly, they're quality rather than I don't care about the optics. It doesn't matter.
But it does. It does matter in that
it matters when it's for your argument. You're right. You're absolutely right in that. But
so
I think
my thing is if you want to go after Colangelo, if you want to say I think this was a bad move and it continues to be a bad move and it is being proven wrong, you point out and you say he did not do his due diligence in pursuing the best candidate available for GM.
Exactly.
Or you say just the fact that these rumors have been mentioned with them seeking short-term options is a flawed approach. The New Orleans thing is interesting because it's pretty clear that Joel is finally making progress.
Yeah.
And one of the biggest things that you and I disagreed on and talked about, but it was a really fascinating conversation, was that 2013 draft, which it basically comes down to I thought that, or is it 14? 14. I thought that they couldn't afford, and I, the more I've thought about it since then, I really have come to this. It was the specific combination of Joel at 3 and then taking Saric. It was a combination of those two.
Let's call it what it is, because it wasn't they took Saric. They took Elfrid Payton and then traded down, I think, one or two spots to get Saric and their 2017 first rounder back from Orlando.
Right, and that 2017 first rounder could be hugely valuable.
Exactly, and that first rounder was traded in the Bynum trade.
Right. So even if they had taken someone other than Saric with the pick that they got from Orlando, I still would have been okay. My instinctive reaction is, man, you cannot do this after you've just tanked off, after you've blown off the year. Like, you got to do something to have something next year. You got to have something going forward.
Well, it was too long. It was Nerlens, because Nerlens missed his first season, so the rookie coming into that year was Nerlens from the year before. So I get it. I mean, that 2014 draft was certainly a ballsy move, like on every account, saying like we're going to double down on the longest view in the room.
But what wound up happening that I've wound up arguing with so many Sixers fans about was, you know, I can disagree, and this really leads into the most fascinating conversation, which is this draft, actually. Because one of the things that you mentioned is you're like, I have some concerns that Sam Hinkie may struggle as a talent evaluator. And that was kind of my thing is, if you question Hinkie, it was about you just don't trust the process and you're short-minded and you have this like very short-term view and you're traditional. And I'm like, no, like I really buy into the idea. I do buy into the idea that, like, for instance, if the Grizzlies lose Mike Conley, I have outright said they need to trade Marc Gasol, Zach Randolph, Tony, which is going to be a heartbreaking end to a glorious era that honestly like helped the community more than it won games in basketball terms. Like that team means a lot to the city. And even I'm like, look, from a franchise perspective, if you're talking to me about basketball, if Mike Conley leaves, you liquidate everything for draft picks.
Absolutely.
And I'm still in on it.
And I think you've gotten more than you deserve, but you also
I'm definitely an antagonist. There's no question on that.
You bring it on yourself sometimes. I think you fight on either side, and I do the same thing sometimes where you play devil's advocate in any argument that you're in.
So what's interesting is going into the draft, I really do think that a lot of the process folks were kind of like had the bottle of whiskey nearby, right?
Absolutely. And I was not expecting stuff, and it wasn't, and to some extent it was unfair to Brian. I really do dislike Jerry because he leaked things to the media. He turned ownership against Sam. He's just out for himself more than he is out for the long-term success of the team. That's what it boiled down to. Like he's on the board of like a for-profit college, and he got
But now you're back into the personal.
But it's not personal because he got like he used Sixers workouts. Some guy who played basketball at that college, Grand Canyon University, I think it's called, came into the Sixers for a workout, and it's like. It's those kinds of things where it's like, that's just a little slimy. Like, it's a little slimy that you're on the board of a for-profit college where Dan Marley is your head coach, and you're like, hey, I'll do this guy a solid and bring him on here to like for my own benefit so people will go to this college more. It's obviously, that doesn't impact the Sixers basketball team much, but there's enough slimy things that he's
but
done.
But there's just as many things that people accuse Sam of. Like, there were just as many things. Like, how they handled KJ McDaniels. Like, all of the stuff.
You want to talk about the KJ trade? Let's talk about the KJ trade. KJ is going to did what a lot of, I think, second rounders in this draft will do in terms of contracts, which is he bet on himself. He said, I shouldn't be a second rounder. I want to go get an actual contract, not like a 4-year minimum deal.
Right.
And he bet on himself, and the Sixers saw that happening. They wanted to sign him. They were offering. Hinkie was offering McDaniels the biggest second-round contract anyone's ever gotten. And KJ said, no, I want to bet on myself and go to free agency after a year, which is a ballsy move. And it worked out, and Hinkie was like, okay, well, here we are at the trade deadline. We're not going to overpay for this guy, so we'll try to trade him for some value. And they got some value back. So
what'd they get in that deal?
They got Isaiah Cannon and the pick that ultimately became Rashawn Holmes, I think.
Okay. All right. If we're gonna say that's value. I mean, I like Isaiah Cannon a lot.
Well, what's KJ McDaniels doing? He's not doing great.
But that's one of the problems. And like, I think James Herbert, if he was here, who by the way wanted to be on this podcast until he realized he would just echo everything you were saying. I think James would probably agree with me that it's just been unfortunate that he wound up on the Rockets and couldn't get playing time because he was on now this team and like they kind of buried him. And it's just like, I really feel like if they just kept KJ, like he could have helped them. Like they would have been in a better spot going forward if they just kept KJ.
Yeah. But ultimately, okay, let's stay broad for a second because we as Sixers fans, as process trusters are fighting battles on like 18 fronts. The one front that we're fighting on, which is like most people in Philadelphia and mainstream media in Philadelphia and beat writers in Philadelphia, are the Sam Hinkie is a fraud front. And just like, he sucks, he doesn't know what he's doing, it's a Ponzi scheme. It's like those horrible arguments that there's no alternative, there's no nuance, there's no anything. Marcus Hayes is a writer for, I think, the Inquirer in Philly, and he suggested today that the Sixers trade Nerlens Noel and the Lakers pick for Sean Livingston.
Yikes.
So that's what we're fighting against on the one hand. And then there's people that are like, hey, I think I think the Okafor pick was maybe not great. I think the KJ trade could have been better. I think the Sarr trade. And Hinkie would agree with you. Hinkie doesn't think he's like perfect or did everything right. And we don't either. My biggest issue with the Hinkie era was the Julian Okafor trade, draft pick.
But you also think you told me that you thought that was kind of that was a reactionary move to the pressure that was mounting on him to get better immediately.
Yeah, and we've heard and there's been some things written and alluded to that ownership pressured Hinkie not to take Porzingis.
Yeah.
I
do want to comment on this because like you've thrown stuff out about how Colangelo buried Sam in the media and all these things. I'm going to go on record right now as saying that even the people that have informed me on these subject matters, like I do not trust on both, because I've heard things on both sides and I don't trust any of them. I tend to stay out of these things because when someone leaves an organization the way that Sam left, there's bad blood on both sides.
Totally.
And everybody is. So for me, it becomes this thing of is like, well, who do you believe? And I'm like, I don't believe anybody. I think unless you were in there and you know, and even then, here's the amazing thing. Cause I've seen this this happens in real life, not in NBA crazy drama world, but in real life, you know, people get fired or pushed out of businesses, of organizations, of offices. And then if you talk to them, they say there were these people and they were manipulative and they forced me out and they were totally wrong and they're just slime. And then the other side says, well, no, like there were real problems with their performance and we had issues and we felt like we had to make a change. And they both are 100% like certain that they're like no one's gonna look at them. Like Jerry Colangelo's not gonna be like, I am slimy.
Yeah.
Like he's not petting his cat in a swivel chair in front of four monitors like some supervillain. Like
sure.
There's these perspectives. So I don't. Everybody and I don't.
Thinks that they're the good guy.
And it's not that I don't think that things were that it's unfortunate because I didn't think he got a fair shake. I think that if you were gonna remove Sam Hinkie, it had to be at the end of this year. You had to be like, okay, he put all of this into this draft, even though he's put a lot into the previous drafts.
Mm-hmm.
He put a lot into this one. He's finally got a number one pick, which if you want to say like, well, you're tanking, you're trying to get that number one pick, even though I'm not entirely certain about how good Ben Simmons is going to be. Like, you have to give him to the end of this year. And then you, because at the end of this year, we're going to look at this and we're going to be, and everyone's going to be like, the Sixers have a crazy amount of talent.
I think people are looking at like that right now.
Yeah.
And here's the thing: is like you can quibble with minor moves. We do. We argue with stuff. Would they have been better served to find a veteran point guard last year to like help Nerlens and Jahlil?
Yes. Before?
Sure. Yeah. And I think whether or not Hinkie thought Kendall Marshall would be ready or not, when they thought he was going to be good enough, whatever. There's a lot that goes into it. It's not a simple thing, but you have to get past the first hurdle of the argument, which is. Look at what they did, what they were in 2013, when they owed two first-round draft picks in the Arnett Moultrie trade and the Bynum trade. They had essentially Drew and nobody else. They had Drew and then Evan Turner, who wasn't as good as he is now, Thad Young, who was expiring, Spencer Hawes. Like, those were their best players. Like, there wasn't like a full cupboard of like successful players that they could work with. Hinkie went in and said, hey, I think we got to tear it down. And they did, and it took maybe a year longer than he thought it was going to take just because of how the lottery shook out, Joel Embiid's injury, Dario Saric's situation, whether or not he's coming over in 2 years, 1 year, whatever. But, like, if your claim is the process was then, like, how can you look at 2013 and then look at 2016 and say, oh, I guess, you know, it didn't work. I was right all along. Like, there's no argument to be made that, like, things are headed in a much better direction, and that's because of Hinkie. Now, you can say, okay, it's easy to tank. It's easy to tear down a roster and make, you know, rip off the Kings for the future and just accept cap space, accept, like, JaVale McGee's contract so they can get a first-round pick, which is what became Timothy Luwawu. So, it is easy, but... teams aren't that patient. Organizations aren't that patient. Not many teams do it as long as the Sixers have done it. So now they're set up flexibly. They have a lot of young talent. And it would have been the right decision if they didn't get the number one pick this year. And now it's even more the right decision because finally the lottery worked in their favor.
You know what I really think is because, like you said, everyone had that bottle of whiskey nearby. And then it was really amazing watching Sixers Twitter because it's like, all right, they got Simmons. They knew they were going to get Simmons. And then it was like, all right, here we go. What's going to be next? Are they going to trade Nerlens and a pick for, you know, Sean Livingston or, you know, Andrew Nicholson or whoever? And instead, they nab Luwawu at 24.
Mm-hmm.
And then they get Furkan Korkmaz at 26. And
yeah.
I have long been a non-Euro guy. And being in Denver has basically beaten it out of me because half of their roster are Euros and they're all really good. But Luwawu and Korkmaz were two guys I was pretty high on, especially in the top 20. And to get them at 24 and 26, like you look at your like Simmons, Luwawu, Korkmaz, like that's just a great haul. Like
yeah. They
took the right guys. They didn't take like fourth year seniors from, you know, Copperhead State. They took.
Exactly.
High upside guys. They were very process moves.
Exactly. And I think that's why you have to look at the Hinkie and Colangelo eras now as hand in hand. You can't say one move is this guy, one move is this guy, because Colangelo made picks that I support very strongly, but they were the picks that Sam Hinkie got him. So he didn't move up, he didn't move around, he didn't do anything aside from wait until it was his turn to make a pick.
But he took the right guys.
He took well, yeah, exactly. I think he's the right guys. I'm not gonna.
Yeah, they could be wanting to be in just as bad, but
exactly.
But
at least philosophically, it was here's guys that aren't NBA ready theoretically and have high upside.
And it's why
and
honestly
aren't just like optics picks.
Not just because of the way of how ugly it's gotten, but I really am. I'm disappointed in all sides of this. I'm disappointed in Colangelo for exerting a power move. I'm disappointed in Hinkie for kind of being intractable in terms of being like, it's like we're going to do this. Like, there's only one way this can work. And most of all, I'm disappointed in ownership for not being like, look, you struggle with talent evaluation. This guy knows basketball. You know basketball, but this guy really understands the cap and asset evaluation. I need you to work together. You're going to figure this out. We can get something really good here if we meld the two approaches. Because that was always a problem, is that Sam would be like, their asset value was insanely high. Their basketball value was really questionable.
Sure. That's for me why the Okafor draft pick was bad. Hinkie took Okafor because he's like, oh, I'll just trade him.
Right.
Because he'll get stats and I'll trade him for value. But there was basketball elements in that, you know, I don't think he figured Nerlens and Jahlil would be that bad together.
And it's also interesting in that the Nerlens thing is very interesting. In that, because what I keep wondering is, okay, how would this move look if Hinkie were to do it? Because even when he were in charge, Nerlens was being shopped all the way back to last year. Mm-hmm. Like, there were reports long time coming that Nerlens was being shopped, which was always interesting to those of us on the outside, because Jahlil, you get. It did not take long to see Jahlil in an NBA environment and be like, oh, he's going to get a lot of points and be terrible defensively, and that's who he's going to be. Like,
yeah.
He is exactly who we thought he was going to be.
Like, exactly, this is, yeah.
And it's why I argued, you know, and to this day, people are, and like now people are like, well, you should. They definitely should. Like, the Lakers should have taken Jahlil Okafor over D'Angelo Russell. I'm like, that's insane.
Yeah.
Like, D'Angelo Russell's upside is light years, to borrow Joe Lacob, beyond Jahlil Okafor's, because, mm-hmm. you know, Russell, if he develops his body and starts to, and if he gets into a mindset where he's like, I'm going to become a good defender, because he has that kind of mentality, once he outgrows being the kid that screwed with Nick Young and did all these, and all this immaturity and the problems that he had under Byron Scott, which were not entirely Byron Scott, but were in large part Byron Scott. Once he gets past all that kind of stuff, like, D'Angelo Russell can be a dynamic and influential power, like a phenomenal two-way guard. Even if he's just on the offensive side, he's going to be able to do so much more than just Okafor racking up rebounds and points, which totally. Rebounds and points matter.
Well, he was a really bad rebounder last year, so not even.
I have hope long term for him to improve in that area.
Yeah, but, I agree. And also, weirdly, last year he like lost his passing ability, which is unfortunate.
I mean, look, everything went wrong last year.
Yeah, and he still put up like pretty decent numbers,
exactly,
on offense. So you know? I think he's going to be a numbers guy for like a just accruing stats guy for a while.
Jahlil's going to be pretty good, but like, yeah. I mean, you know, I guess here's an interesting way to kind of look at it. Like, would you rather have Jahlil Okafor at his age or Andrew Kirilenko when he was that age? And it's like, man, Andrew Kirilenko would help you in a lot more ways. And it would, yeah. And see, now I'm going to be spending the rest of the day thinking about Nerlens Noel and Andrew Kirilenko at 19 playing together.
Yeah, that'd be cool. No, I mean, that's the thing, is that we're now at a place where, like, Colangelo's working with some of Hinkie's staff, all of Hinkie's players, and we're seeing it, like, through the lens of, like, all right, so what's the worst thing that could happen where ownership is looking to make, you know, make them respectable. And Mark Stein just had a report while we're doing this podcast that the Sixers plan to be serious suitors for Harrison Barnes. So it's like, okay, maybe, well, he's young. He's hopefully got more upside and room to grow. But, you know, if they start looking at, like, just veterans for the sake of veterans, which, okay, we can get a couple, but, like, it's tough. It's tough to, because it's always going to feel a little bit like it's like a sort of bastardized version of what it could have been.
The only thing I would say is I would advise you and the movement, because if people kind of likened you to a cult, and I've kind of changed my mind on that. You're not like a cult. You're like an underground political movement. That's a little bit more accurate.
I think so. Like, I think you're right.
You guys meet up in like beneath coffee shops, and you wear berets, and like,
I look great in a beret.
Yeah, and you're wearing, yeah. That's what I would see. Look, if they went out and they maxed Evan Turner, yeah. Okay.
Oh, jeez.
Like, not good, right?
Yeah.
Like going down my top 100 list. If they were to go out and, man, there's just a lot of former Sixers on this list. They could just go out. They could max Evan Turner and give a huge offer to Maurice Spates and just roll this thing back.
Oh, God. It's been tough.
Trade Nerlens for Iguodala. You could just piece him, and then Drew is available too.
Everybody, the whole gang's back together. Doug Collins coming in. It's gonna be great.
But like, I mean, you know, Barnes, I think is that's not a bad idea because their cap sheet is so wide open. Like they could max Barnes, and it's not gonna impact. It's not gonna be like, oh well, they were gonna be in line to get. You know, Russell Westbrook next year, but they don't have the cap space because exactly. Like that's not going to happen, right?
Yeah.
So it's kind of worth taking the flyer on. But I agree with you. Like if they go out and they're like, all right, we're going to give Luol Deng 2 years, $40 million. Like
it's
why?
Like fine. Well, yeah. Why is to make themselves more respectable? And I do see an argument to build Simmons and Embiid, build a team around them that can like play and help them now.
But I think a better idea is go get a point guard. I don't know where. I think that was the reason that the Teague May thing makes sense to me, because if you put any point guard on that team, all of a sudden all of the stuff, the random flotsam that they have accumulated is going to kind of start to form into a structure.
Well, let's talk about the theoretics of a Teague trade, because it was Nerlens, who's going to be a restricted free agent at the end of the year, versus Teague, who's expiring.
Yeah.
So the best case scenario is Teague has a really good year at age 28. And then you have to give him a max contract.
Yep.
And then you're paying him 30-some million at age 33.
And then like if you add in the Barnes thing, it's like all of a sudden now you've got...
You lock yourself into, you know, you hope that Simmons...
You're looking at $54 million for Teague and Barnes.
Exactly, which is just insane. So, honestly, there was a rumor on draft night where it was like, okay, Houston wants Nerlens. What about Nerlens for Patrick Beverley and Trevor Ariza? Which isn't like they're not crazy better than Jeff Teague. I would take Beverly over Teague individually, but then you factor in contracts, and now you have 3 years instead of that. So they're younger. It fits better as a 3-point shooter and defense.
And even then, they didn't pull the trigger because I think
Well, we don't know what's real, what's not real, but that at least makes more sense to me. The Teague trade never made sense because if you look at the worst case scenario, is he sucks and you just traded Nerlens for an expiring point guard, coming off his best year. Best 3-point shooting year by a lot. He's a 34% career 3-point shooter before he shot 40% last year. So, who knows if that's real?
Let me float some names at you. We're
float
actually
in
the basketball top. We're floating away from the process, but I do want to kind of float this at you.
Okay.
What if you gave Jared Bayless 2 years, 28?
Great.
You got to overpay because it's the Sixers.
I'm fine with it. Two years. Anything 2 years is fine. Just like guys that can shoot. Guys that can defend a little bit, hopefully.
See, if you had Jared Bayless and Etuan Moore on value contracts, on short-term value contracts,
mm-hmm.
and if it's Bayless, Etuan Moore,
Covington,
RC3, Embiid, Okafor,
and Simmons, Embiid.
That's probably going to be in there too, right? But even if you bring Etuan Moore off the bench, like however you figure it out, like. Okay, you got some stuff now. You've got some stuff. Like, I think I've long thought this about Ben Simmons. I wrote about this all the way back in January. I love the concept of him as kind of an evolved version, a mutated version of Draymond Green.
Mm-hmm.
Because everyone says, well, he can't shoot. I'm like, if you look at the percentages, Draymond's actually not that great of a shooter. Like, he has stretches where he knocks down 5 in a row, and then, yeah.
But it's less that Simmons can't shoot, it's that he didn't shoot at all.
And even if you take that, the shooting part out of it, like Ben Simmons setting a pick and then rolling to the rim on the short roll with the ball with options to pass, drive, or dunk.
Yeah.
Like, that's a weapon. That's a real weapon.
Yeah.
So I like the idea of like Simmons and Embiid playing together. Like that's a real, mm-hmm. I'm like, ooh, that would be very interesting. And that's kind of the thing with Nerlens is I'm like, look, you know, Nerlens wasn't necessarily the guy anyway. It was, we're going to trade Drew and we're going to get 2 picks.
I think Nerlens has had 2 historically good defensive seasons for how young he is. It remains to be seen. I mean, he was playing out of position last year also. He was playing a lot of 4, but fact is he can protect the rim and also switch on pick and rolls and defend in space. Like, he's a really very modern NBA center. I think you look at what Tristan Thompson did for the Cavs, and Nerlens can do that while also protecting the rim at a better rate. Now, obviously, Nerlens doesn't have Tristan's hands. He doesn't have his, like, he's sort of more fluid. Nerlens is sort of, like, wonky when he runs and stuff, but he's young and has to put on weight.
I would also say Nerlens' defensive instincts are way better than Tristan's. So
yeah, absolutely. So there's, you know, it's tough because people say that Nerlens is a liability on offense, and I disagree with that. He's just not. You just don't ask him to do much more than what DeAndre Jordan does on offense, and then you know he's shooting efficiently. When Nerlens was playing with Ish Smith towards the end of the season, like he was shooting some of the highest percentages in the league, and so he's just like catching lobs and finishing inside. That's all. I mean, you're not going to ask him to do much more than that,
right? I think the problem, and I've started to think about this because I said this about Marquise Chris actually in the draft, which is I said. I think Marquise Chris could be an impact player in the league, the kind of game-changing defensive force that every team kind of looks for. The problem is he's not going to be that on the rookie contract that you're going to have him on, and he may not be that on the 8 years after you extend him off of his rookie deal.
Yeah.
Like, you can get him – it's like, well, you get him for cheap. Well, yeah, but he's going to be worth that cheapness. That's what he's going to be valued at because it's going to take him so long to learn. I kind of feel the same way about Noel where I think at 28 – Nerlens Noel is going to be a defensive monster. He's going to be a two-way switching, as long as his knees hold up, dynamic, like, rim erasing. I've always kind of said I see him as like a hyper Camby. If Camby, because Camby for a long time there in the mid-2000s was basically just chasing blocks. That was all he was doing. Is he won defensive player of the year by chasing blocks and rebounds. And then he went, I think, to the Clippers and a couple of other places. And he was actually like a really effective, helpful defensive player. So when he won defensive player of the year, he was chasing stats. I think that Noel can have those kind of stats with the defensive impact that he's going to have. But right now, for where the Sixers are, I honestly look at it and I say, you know what? They should be trying to leverage him. Like, they should be trying to get assets back for him. I think that it'd be okay if they moved both him and Okafor and were just like, if Joel's healthy, which is the thing.
And it's tough to plan on that. That's the difference, is that there's a lot of among like Sixers process people, there are factions of pro Okafor, anti Okafor. There's been like a divide, like a seismic, like civil war. But it boils down to, for me, if Embiid, you want an insurance policy for Embiid because you can't just count on him and assume he's going to be healthy after 2 years of not playing. But if you need a guy behind him, you'd rather have the guy who can protect the rim and rebound and defend rather than Jahlil. Like, it's you need Nerlens. Jahlil is kind of a luxury. It'd be cool to see Jahlil do kind of what Cantor's doing on Oklahoma City, which is like destroy second units and like second unit big men and just like have that option down low. You can go get you a bucket kind of thing. But I mean, you saw in the finals, like you can't in real situations, in real NBA games, when it really matters, you can't play guys that can't defend.
Yeah. Defense is more valuable than it ever has been. And it's weird because even for like a young team, I think that's one of the weird things is usually young teams are great offensively and a nightmare defensively.
Yeah. Minnesota.
And the Sixers have kind of been the opposite, where the defense has been atrocious, don't get me wrong, but if you look at it and you say what are their strengths, it's like, you know what, if they get into a real groove, they can play some defense. They've got length. Brown's a good defensive coach. Like there's kind of a formula there. They just can't do anything offensively, which again I get back to, man, if they just had a point guard, if they just had a point guard.
But that's the thing, is that like if they had a point guard last year, name a point guard they could have signed last year.
I think you probably could have traded an asset pretty easily for, like, I know you're going to hate this, but, like, Jarrett Jack.
Okay, Jarrett Jack. If you had Jarrett Jack, maybe you end up with a third pick and you get Jaylen Brown.
True, yeah.
Wouldn't you rather have, I mean, regardless of what you think and Simmons, but wouldn't you rather have...
The response then is you can be the worst and still, like, you happen to wind up with the number one draft lottery spot and the number one pick, but we know that 75% of the time that doesn't happen.
Yeah, well, here's the thing, is that the Sixers have been talking about as a historically bad team, like the worst team ever. But last year was the first year that they had the worst record in the league.
They really, and that was the thing, is like I said, everything went wrong. I really thought they were going to be better last year. That was why we were so frustrated.
So did I, man. I really, really thought that they were going to be. I took a huge L on that. Like, but I was saying like 28 wins. I missed by a few. But yeah. I think you stay big picture. The issue for a lot of people is how long it took. And I think the issue for a lot of people is the fact that like tanking was so bald and stuff. The difference in the crux of the argument, and because I've gotten into so many goddamn arguments with people on Twitter where it's just like, this is pointless. This is you. They want different things. People at Liberty Ballers, me and Spike, we want it like a perennial championship contender. You watch the finals. You watch like Oklahoma City. You watch good teams play, and you see how far away any Sixers team ever since the mid-80s has it was even close to that. Those Iverson teams, it was Iverson and a bunch of scrubs. Like, it was a they were a bad team. They were the worst NBA Finals team ever. That Iverson team in 01. But so it's like I don't want to go win 42 games and limp into the 8th seed. I don't want that. We've been there. The years after Iverson, late Iverson, and then into Eddie Jordan and everything, into Doug, it was miserable. It was pointless. It was worthless. It didn't make anybody happy. It was just a waste of time. And so the fact that Hinkie came in and the ownership was like, yo, we're going to try something. We're not going to settle for being in the middle. We're going to go after big stuff. And that's going to be tough for a couple years, but we're really going after it. And so it boils down to, okay, people, they became a joke, and people said it just took too long.
Yeah.
And so let's say Embiid and Sarge came over last year, and then we got Simmons the year before, whatever. So say it was 1 year less. Is 1 year really the big is this huge difference? Is one year? If you look at the Sixers' history and you look at their record in the mid-2000s, would 1 year of 37 wins and a waste when a worthless team, like, would that have done it for you? I think ultimately when you're building a perennial contender, which is what hopefully the Sixers are doing, you stay – 1 year is nothing. I'm happy to waste another year. If they need another year to get a point guard in the 2017 NBA draft, fine. Because, like, the payoffs will be worth it. And that's ultimately what people that trusted the process were looking at. We're like, we'll sacrifice now for long-term gain later.
For me, I look back on it as the idea of let's not build a mid-level building. Let's build a skyscraper. Let's build an amazing complex.
You can't get to the moon by climbing a tree. That's a Sam Hinkie quote also.
Yeah. So, like, let's build something grand. Let's build something amazing. Let's put the best tech into it. Because a lot of the infrastructure stuff that he built into that team is amazing, right? And that's all very forward-thinking and progressive stuff.
Yeah. New practice facility coming in to attract free agents. It's going to be amazing. All that stuff.
The biotech, the approach to health, all of it. All of it. Was really good. But ironically to me, we use the word process, it was the plan was good. The process for the plan was what failed. And not
but you look at the team now and you can say that you think it failed?
I do.
And it that's
didn't
crazy to
but
me.
The difference is it didn't fail big. That's the difference. Is it didn't fail big. It failed really, really small. But when part of the inherent structure of it was failure on purpose, failing in those margin areas hurts a lot.
But how do they fail? I mean, you're looking at the future where you have a lot of cap space, a lot of flexibility. The Lakers pick next year, the Kings pick swap next year, the unprotected Kings pick in 2019. Like, there's a lot of good stuff now and more stuff in the future.
Because this is something I've become very big on. And I've had these huge swings throughout my career of evaluating this kind of stuff because this is the stuff I care about the most. Like, how to build basketball teams is really
Absolutely.
What I care about the most.
Sharp talked about team building Twitter on his last podcast, and I'm like all in on team building Twitter. Yeah. That's all I want to talk about.
There is, to me, an element where we start to talk about assets as having absolute positive value and that there's very little consideration for the possibility of assets turning bad is never considered. We only look at them as possible opportunity.
Yeah.
And,
well, they are certainly possible opportunities.
And this is why the biggest problem with Boston is that Boston accumulated asset after asset after asset after asset, and they've turned it into, you look at the roster and you go,
But the difference in Boston is that they don't have a guy to build around yet. And they might get it next year with the Nets pick in the 2017 draft, but they don't have that guy yet. The Sixers have maybe two of them. They might, they're like locked, regardless if you think about them, of Simmons and Embiid, they're certainly billed as guys you can build your team around. So if they trade Nerlens and or Jahlil for a point guard and a wing player, all of a sudden, that's as good as Minnesota.
Good. And I think the problem with that approach is you have to say you lost all these games and you still didn't get that guy until this year, right? And we're going to say the result is not there. So, and there are other teams that got good players in these other spots, right? Like, they got really good players. Or, you know, and we don't know. That's going to be one of the interesting things that's going to happen is, are we going to see stuff like we saw in 2009, where a lot of guys that went later became like real stars, and they were outliers. Like, you talked about watching the finals, and that was kind of the first thing I had, which is, man, so few of the teams in the Eastern, like, if you look at the Eastern Conference Finals, the only team that had a real plan that meant to go where they landed, if we're going to be honest, is the Oklahoma City Thunder. Because the Warriors, for all of their light years ahead mechanics, are entirely dependent upon Steph Curry's outlier shooting performance, which is unpredictable and unlike anything that basketball has ever seen, and he's on a contract that makes him affordable. Cleveland, it was entirely dependent upon the fact that the best player in the universe happened to have been born in the state of Ohio.
Absolutely. It's a lot of luck. It's a lot
Toronto,
of luck.
Toronto is there entirely because Masai Ujiri wanted to get rid of Rudy Gay so badly that he took a mishmash, which magically came together. So all of these things coming together, so it's like they may have the guys in Joel Embiid and Ben Simmons. And in 4 years, you're absolutely right that this could look amazing. And that actually does bear out an interesting question, because you said, you know, we're going to have, you know, Sam's whole line of we're going to take the longest view in the room.
Yeah.
I think there is a lesson to be taken from how all of this happened, which is, the short term isn't irrelevant. It's not as important as the long term. But I think that was the line that wound up really hurting the entire situation, was to pretend that short term is irrelevant. I think we can say, for whether it's, and this is the thing, is whether it's fair or not, whether it's even logical or not, just built into the kind of the laws of how the NBA works, about with fans and expectations and media and all of, and the league and all of these things factored into it, you have to consider the short term in some capacity, or else it's not going, eventually this is what's going to happen.
I think it boils down to what you believe a wasted year is. Do you think that, how many teams in the league do you think had a wasted year this year? Because I would say, either if you're building for the future, like a Minnesota, maybe Milwaukee, even though they took a huge step back, and then the teams that competed in the conference finals. And that's, like, would you rather the Sixers have been Orlando? Having been, like, minimally better than the Sixers the last 4 years, but also not nearly as set up for the future as them?
See, yeah, I don't.
I
think here's the Sixers this is actually what's interesting is you should get on a podcast with somebody from Portland, actually.
Yeah.
And it would be really interesting to see, because Portland has had a number of these teams, and even though their delusional sect will believe that they're headed towards a championship, which I do not understand how you can get there. But there is kind of this thing of, because I kept telling Portland, I was like, man, you guys should tank and keep the pick. Like, what's this going to do you? Where are you really going?
It's fun. It's fun to be in the playoffs to challenge.
And that's kind of the thing, right? Is that there are these years, and there are a lot of these years, man. Because I run into the same thing with Memphis, right? Where people say, well, wait, what does it matter? Like, you're going to get knocked out in the second round. What does it matter? And I'm like, this team matters to Memphis a lot.
Like, but it's that's the thing. The Sixers teams that were making the playoffs didn't matter to the Philadelphia because everyone knew.
But
it's not the right thing to do in every situation.
Right.
I would never say
that's
tanking
is
a thing to do all the time.
That's kind of the thing is, I understand the direction of let's not sell for mediocrity based off of what we did for 10 years, and let's instead try and do something grand.
Yeah.
But I also think that what winds up, because you want to defend that viewpoint, it does wind up saying, well, what's the point? Like, there's no point in all the, like you just said, like, what's the point in all these teams? And it's like, well, no, I think if you're trying to give your fans a good year with a team that they can root for, I think a lot of the teams that have been good, like Toronto, wouldn't trade this run. Like, they would trade it for a championship, sure.
But the difference is Toronto won 56 games this year, and those Sixers teams were topping out at like 43.
Yeah, I'm never going to argue with you that the 2012 Sixers were something to strive for.
They were awful.
Yeah,
I remember.
And I get why Sixers fans are so much like, never again. Right?
Yes, never again. Exactly. I mean, would you trade all of Portland, including their assets, not the city, all of Portland's assets for all the Sixers' assets? Because I would rather have the Sixers any day.
I'd rather have Dame.
I'm not a Dame fan.
That's okay.
That's me personally. Other people might disagree.
Okay, but I mean, if you want to talk about Simmons and Embiid as potential core pieces, like, Damian Lillard has earned the respect of being like, no, no, no. That guy 100%, like, we're not trading him, right?
I think I don't know. I'm not a huge Dame fan. I think, you know, you look at the next year.
You wouldn't trade Jahlil Okafor right now for Damian Lillard?
Oh, I would trade
Jahlil. Would you trade Joel Embiid right now for Damian Lillard?
Would I trade Embiid right now for Damian Lillard? That's a very good question, what? And I don't know that I want to answer it.
That's amazing. That's awesome. That's so great. Okay, well, this has been a lot of fun. Do you have any closing thoughts that you want to kind of end with about I've heard the phrase, this isn't over, the process hasn't ended, it continues. I've heard that kind of line.
Sure. Yeah, I think ultimately you just look at, like, I don't know. I think it boils down to what your opinion of a wasted year was. If you're a Sixers fan and you just went away for the last 3 years, that's totally your prerogative and that's fine. But you can't say on the one hand, yo, Hinkie sucks, he was a fraud, he's awful, he did a terrible job, and I'm glad he's fired, while also looking at the Sixers team right now and go, man, things are great, we're going to be good soon. Like, you have to consider both things. And there's just this the narrative of Hinkie, like, always wanting to lose, never going to put it together. Like, this was going to be the offseason, or it was building towards this and towards other stuff. So it would have been cool to see Hinkie, like, get to complete his whole plan and figure it all out. Did he have mistakes? And he made mistakes? Of course. Whether or not he should have talked more to the media, that's a separate argument based on beat writers who just want to, like, have a fun time at their job, and Colangelo makes their job easier.
I don't think it's a fun time. I think it's – I understand the perspective of
– they just want quotes. They want to make their job easier.
I will say this. I consider – if you ask me, like, what's the role of sports media, which is a dangerous question to me, it is a voice for the fan. It's if the fans are talking about, well, what's going on with this guy? Like, why is this happening? Why did they do this? The reporters are ones that go and say, hey, why did you do this? What was the thought process? Where are you guys? Like, why should fans not be concerned about this? Why should fans be concerned about this?
The difference is, especially with the Sixers, beat writers aren't necessarily fans of the team. They want to have, and I talked to a beat writer about this years ago, they enjoyed the 2012 playoff run because they got to see them play Chicago and then go to the next round and play Boston, take them to seven. And it was cool for them. Like, hey, my job is entertaining. My job is fun. They don't give a crap about how the Sixers are going to be in 5 years and if they're contenders in 5 years because they want to make their job easier. Whether or not the quotes thing is a different thing. But I just think that it's misrepresenting the story and what's happening if you're a beat writer and saying the Sixers are bad, Hinkie's a fraud, in so many words, and just like leaning all the slants to that. And then Colangelo comes in and now he gives you quotes and you're like, oh, now here's the guy to come and make action. Now here's the guy he's going to lead them to the right places because he has a history. And it's like, it just shows everybody has a bias. Everybody has an agenda. And
that I would agree with, because I know, like, there are beat reporters that I really respect, but they do lean towards traditionalist. The difference is that I don't necessarily look at it. Like, I understand your perspective as a fan, but like, for me and where I'm at, and I'm just like, without all of the stuff that gets thrown at me constantly in this kind of way too over sensory overload situation I put myself in regarding the NBA, I wind up being like, you know what? There's real points on both sides. Like, there really are.
I don't think that there's real points on the other
side.
I've agreed with things that you've said today, for sure. And there's things you can look at and tinker with. But if you're saying, hey, the Sixers shouldn't have tanked, then you have a moral opposition to tanking.
Yeah,
not
sure.
You haven't offered a better substitute. No one's ever said, here's what they should have done in 2013 instead of all of these things. There's things you can quibble with, and because it's all subjective. But until you go in there and say, okay, Sam, what you should have done is these things. And I just think that the argument of, like, making fun of the Sixers for being bad and then also being like, well, they're set up for the future, but Hinkie's a fraud, it contradicts itself.
No, I agree. I will say that. You cannot be like, you know, now, you know, Jerry Colangelo has set the team up to really succeed. It's like, well, no, everything has been built off of this. You know, if he'd come in and he'd traded the number one pick for Harden and traded Okafor and Embiid for whoever, if he had pulled off like a series of superstar trades that had his mark on them, then sure.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. But
that's what it boils down to for me.
And I agree with that. But I think, you know, the perception stuff is tough because I was shocked. I kind of thought that the idea of people being morally opposed to tanking was just kind of a people on Twitter thing. I thought it was just one of those things.
Oh, no. I think it's more – it's less, even less on Twitter. I agree. More in person. There's a lot of – there's people just like, you know, hanging out, talking about the Sixers, casual don't fan. Know about and Liberty Ballers, casual fans.
Well, here's what's crazy. Like, if you look at it, you say there's casual fans, and that evolves into serious fans, and then that evolves into people that talk about it constantly on Twitter, and then mm-hmm. you evolve that into media, which is a huge section of Twitter, and then you evolve media into front office personnel and actually people with a team. Here's what's crazy. It's a bell curve because – at the end of it, casual fans are like, why are they losing? That's stupid. You should try and win games.
Yeah.
And then on the other end of it, I have talked to league executives who have said, I find it repulsive because, like, as a competitor, I don't understand how you can want to lose. Like,
exactly. And that's the difference, that it's being represented as if it's the same argument.
Yeah.
And they want the same thing, but they don't want the same thing.
Right.
I want, and I think what a lot of people in the process community want, I'm calling it a community, I don't know what I'm doing, is
the movement, a
perennial contender. And I will do anything short of slaughtering families to get there. You watch Golden State now, and like, how much would you kill to be a Golden State fan? Wouldn't it be the coolest thing in the world to have, like, we're set up, we're going to be amazing forever? Like, it'd be insane. And there's 28 other teams, let's say 27.
I've dealt with a lot of Warriors fans. I'm not sure I'm going
to go there. Sure. But it's just this idea. It's like that's the goal. That's what we're all rooting for. We're not like all hoping to just inch into the playoffs and like take the Cavs to five.
It's one of the advantages that I have is I'm very much like a I'm just not like a obviously being with the media. It's like you wind up in a very objective kind of place. And it's when I look at teams, I'm always like, you should just want something good for your team. Like, you should want your, basically my thing is, as long as you're not the Knicks, I think you should be like, there's a lot of ways to be happy. Like, I think there's a lot of ways. I think it's okay. Even though I think that Portland should have tanked last year to keep that pick, I'm also kind of like, you know what? You got a good enough team. You don't really need it. He's not going to get roster space. You're looking to add through guys in free agency. And you had a really fun year, even though you really shouldn't have been in the second round. Like, that was just a fluke thing that happened. But, like, that's fun, and that's fine. I'm the same with Memphis, where I'm like, you know what? Even though they never won a title, people are going to talk about this team forever in Memphis. Like, that's worth it. Like, that's okay. You know? And it's like, you, as long as you don't get stuck in a cycle. I mean, this thing is like, the Kings are a good example of, like, the opposite, right? But then the Kings also tried to build through the draft, like, three times and just were terrible at it.
Yeah, they just made the wrong picks. I think ultimately, we've done that. We've done the, like, you know, fun team, scrappy, Iguodala, Lou Williams. Like, we've done that. We have that experience. We remember it well. Now let's, like, go forward and try to actually.
It'll be do interesting. Something. It'll be interesting to see if the younger Sixers fans, embody what I see from a lot of fans on Twitter, which is, I just want to, like, Kings fans are like this. I just want to be another team. Like, I don't want to be terrible. I don't want to be this big divide. Like, I just want a team, a basketball team I can come home from work and put on and watch and it not be terrible and not
I
be
get
this
that.
Team's thing.
I so get that. But we put the time in.
You want the payoff, yeah. See, for you, you put the investment in, and that's the difference.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I think it's like, I've had this explained to me. It's like, you know, people go to law school and medical school, and they spend a ton of money for 4 years, whatever it is, and they don't make any money for 4 years to, like, learn all this stuff, to get all this information, and then to, like, once you're done, you go out there, and then it pays off. It might not pay off. Maybe you don't get a job. Maybe you suck at it. Whatever. But, like, it's this idea where I'm putting time in, and then it'll pay off down the road. And I think that it's a similar thing with the Sixers. And I'm really excited about the future, even though it's a little weird because, like, now my stepdad is running the team. It's still, like, the future is really, really bright. And for most of my life, the Sixers' future, like, just has not been bright. It's been just, all right, I don't know, maybe we'll sign Matt Harpering. Like, there's no – it was ugly. It was ugly for a long time. And it was pointless in a way that didn't feel pointless, I guess, in Memphis, where it's like, hey, this team is cool, and it has a personality, and it's, like, it's doing something. It felt like we were just – running on a hamster wheel.
Well, I'm glad that you're excited about the future. I hope to be able to have you back on in the future to talk about Ben Simmons and how awesome he is, his Rookie of the Year campaign, and who should get it between Ben Simmons and Joel Embiid.
It's going to be great. That's your civil war right there.
Both of them split together.
Thanks
for doing the podcast. It's been a really great conversation and nice to kind of get away from free agency talk as I've been absorbed in trying to figure out how much money Evan Turner is going to make.
Oh, gosh.
Michael Levin. Rice or Ricky Sanchez podcast, libertyballers.com. Thanks so much.
Thanks, man.